Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast, and we have a real treat for you today. I'm going to be in conversation with fellow textbook writer Larry Autumn-Leaf, someone who I've collaborated with in the past writing about modern China. And today, Larry and myself are going to be discussing the nature of the origins, the cause and the consequences of the Sino-Soviet split. And without further ado, now let's go over to hear from Larry himself. Okay, so Larry, welcome to the Explaining History podcast.
Thank you.
And today we're going to talk about the Sino-Soviet split, this kind of huge rupture in international relations from the 50s through to the 1970s. Firstly, let's look at origins. So, when we're talking about this kind of schism within the communist world, what seems to be the kind of the causation of that? Why do we get this kind of strange state of affairs where the two communist superpowers are moved from kind of relative cooperation to outright hostility?
Yeah, but that's the whole thing, isn't it, Nick? That most students are aware of the Cold War. Very few are aware of the kind of forgotten dimension of China involving itself. And I think, you know, with the exception of the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1969, is the closest the world gets to World War III. Touch wood. And how did we get from, like you say, the two leading communist countries who should logically be allies end up as antagonists? And I think the background actually goes before communism. And if you look at China in the 19th century, they're exploited by foreign powers. Mm-hmm. And I think they are very, very suspicious of any foreign nation's intentions. So I would really look at putting the roots of this disagreement in the 19th century, and I think that's an element that the Soviets initially don't quite appreciate.
Yeah, well, I suppose if you're looking at it from a kind of a Stalinist perspective, your view of what history is, how history functions, and what societies do are informed by Marxist-Leninism, and Marxist-Leninism says that social classes respond in this sort of way. They will overthrow their oppressing class and then create some sort of international solidarity. And therefore, countries with that have had socialist revolutions will therefore cooperate. And, well, nice idea in principle. But as you say, if you take out the kind of the unequal treaties of the 19th century, if you ignore that, if you ignore the fact that China had this from the kind of 1860s through to the 1930s, this really kind of explosion of nationalist sentiment, which is the result of kind of colonization, which is something we never really kind of fully accept, the extent to which China was colonized by European countries, then you'll be selling yourself a misleading picture. And I suppose the part of it, for me, there's a kind of a great deal of Soviet chauvinism towards China, the idea that China should be listening to the Soviet Union because China should be the pupil and the Soviet Union should be the teacher. And I think with Mao's vanity particularly, that was something that was never going to be accepted.
Yeah, vanity and paranoia.
Yes.
A characteristic shared by most dictators.
Yes, yes. So, in 1949, the relationship between Stalin and Mao seems to get off to sort of quite auspicious an auspicious beginning, doesn't it? The two of them, Mao goes to visit Stalin and arranges an economic deal. Probably, I think it's only China's only economic deal.
I would say that Stalin would have thought that the relationship was off to an auspicious start, but Mao's paranoia, because if we remember, obviously, before the CCP came to power, there'd been a civil war raging in China for 20, 30 years,
yes,
in which Stalin had surprisingly been more on the side of the nationalists than the communists, because from his worldview, it was more important for China to be united so that China could then serve Soviet interests of being a solid bulwark against Japan, who
That's
was
true.
Soviet Union's great fear at that time.
Yeah.
So I think straight away, Mao is like, hold on, you're not actually doing this for us. You're not doing this for world communism. You are actually aping the behaviours of the old school imperialists. You were looking out for your self-interest.
Yeah.
And then obviously you get into the, as you implied, the vanity of personalities. And this remarkable scene where Mao gets invited to, I think it's Stalin's 70th birthday party, which, you know, one that I'm sure we would have all liked an invite to. And he kind of expects himself to be the almost your keynote speaker, doesn't he?
Yes.
The star guest, and he's very much just another delegate, and he's left kind of in a villa on his own for days, kind of ruminating and getting more and more paranoid.
Yes.
And then Stalin graces him with his presence and presents an agreement or a proposed financial arrangement that actually catches Mao by surprise. He is expecting a lot more than what he receives, isn't he, in that agreement?
Yeah, it sort of rather resembles kind of a Soviet payday loan. You know, there's a kind of a nice cash injection to begin with, but what Stalin wants is raw materials cheaply for a long, long time. And there's a kind of a flow of Soviet specialists from the Soviet Union to China. I always get the sense with that these sort of technical specialists were there was probably nobody in the Soviet Union that knew anything more about economics or engineering than already existed in China anyway. But they came with a kind of a model of a command economy for Mao to kind of appropriate. Of course, you see, Mao had deviated from Marxist-Leninism since the 1930s, and his various kind of writings whilst fighting a guerrilla war against the nationalists made the point that the peasants in China and anywhere else in the world would be the key revolutionary class that would overthrow capitalism. And this was going to be something that Stalin, and we talk about Stalin's vanity as a kind of a supposed writer and thinker and intellectual, which is how he liked to see himself, and the heir of Leninist thought, there was no way he was going to tolerate any kind of deviation from that sort of strand of Marxist-Leninism.
I'd also probably suggest there might be a kind of racial superiority element to this as well, that the Europeans are not going to be told by the Orientals, who, as you implied earlier, they'd previously colonised, that actually this is the way you run your shop. And so you have that perspective. And then how do you analyse Mao? I suppose, yeah, vanity is a word we keep on coming back to, but I'd also think arrogance and naivety.
Yeah.
The whole premise of Marxism is that the revolution would be based in the industrial working class, the proletariat.
Yeah.
So Mao looks at China, says, well, less than 1% of our country is industrial, so what do we do? I think the vast majority of ideologists would have thought you leave it a generation or two, you develop the industry, and Mao just said, no, we're not going to wait. We have a lot of peasants. You know, over 95% of our country is peasant. They are the poorest. They have the most to benefit. All of those assumptions are correct.
Yeah.
So he says, right, we're going to base it in the peasants.
Yeah.
And there are two, you know, Stalin, not a man known for his sense of humour, refers to Mao as a caveman Marxist, like this incredibly old-fashioned belief, because obviously Russia had gone through an agricultural-based approach of collectivization, which had not gone so successfully.
No.
And then doesn't he refer to him as well as a margarine Marxist? So that's like you're a fake. And like I say, Stalin, not known for humour, but they those nicknames, yeah, they're quite good, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there you have this ideological rift. And I think students assume, I say students, I assumed before I knew about this topic, Russia communist, China communist, but they must work together. They must have very similar beliefs.
Yeah.
And here at the beginning of the relationship, we see that it is built on a false premise. Yeah. There are huge differences.
The way to think about it, I think, is a bit of a thought experiment, is if you took two leading capitalist nations, the USA and at the moment the EU, and one was to argue something so fundamentally different about the workings of capitalism, that, you know, capitalism happens as a result of X, and the other said, well, no, capitalism happens as a result of Y. Trying to have a dialogue between those two countries would present perhaps not the same difficulties, but fundamental difficulties. I mean, you sort of have aspects of that, but nothing near as pronounced as the way in which the Soviet Union and Maoist China interpreted the nature of Marxism.
Yes.
Because, you know, Marxism is a kind of, it goes slightly beyond a political ideology. It is a kind of a theory of history.
The evolution of people.
Yeah. Why do things happen as they happen, is essentially, and how is the next big change in the world going to happen? For countries that aren't, for countries that aren't sort of haven't had Marxist revolutions and are observing this from the outside, these look like obscurantist debates. You know, the debates about transubstantiation during the Reformation or something like that. But they are within, they're enormously, enormously important. And as far as Stalin saw it, I believe that his way of looking at things was, this comes down to a question as, who will lead the communist world? And then it becomes more acute, obviously, when Stalin dies, which is when what we've talked about so far are the kind of like the fissures, the kind of the cracks, and when Stalin dies, those break out. When Khrushchev becomes general secretary, what happens then?
So So what happens? First of all, I think, although there are differences between Stalin and Mao, and that boils over into resentment, no doubt, Mao is a huge admirer of Stalin. He admires all that he's achieved. He admires Stalin's leadership during World War II. He admires Stalin's style of leadership, this utter brutality in the name of the cause. I think Mao's very appreciative of this. And then he is replaced by Khrushchev. Now, Khrushchev is not an intellectual. You know, isn't there that story of Stalin tapping his pipe on Khrushchev's head and saying it's hollow? You know, that Khrushchev's no great thinker. And I think Mao sees Khrushchev as an upstart. He sees him as intellectually inferior, but the head of this huge economic juggernaut that the Soviet Union was coming. So Khrushchev wants to keep Mao on side. He wants unity. So there's this very brief period from 53 to 56 where there's a surge in Soviet support, industrial and military.
Mm-hmm.
And then 1956 with the secret speech, de-Stalinization, then this house of cards really falls down.
Sure.
Because Khrushchev comes along and he says, well, Stalin was despotic, he was brutal. And you could almost imagine Mao listening and saying, yeah, that's right, but that's not actually a bad thing. And Khrushchev's actually saying, this is awful, this is what we need to move away from.
Yeah.
All those accusations levelled at Stalin could be levelled at Mao.
Mm-hmm.
And as we've said, Mao's incredibly paranoid. So what is he going to fear? He's going to fear, and it's a constant through Mao's life, is that Mao Zedong thought, i.e. Maoism, will not survive Mao.
Yeah.
So what will Mao's legacy be? So he sees Khrushchev as undermining Mao, and then it just gets, it gets very petty, really. It's kind of the things almost you'd get two students falling out over. It's kind of, it's not so much what you said, it's that you didn't tell me before that you were going to say it, because, hey, I thought we were supposed to be best friends and respect each other, and now you're acting unilaterally. And Khrushchev must be thinking, who on earth is this guy? You know, for 3 years we've been handing over assistance, hand over foot, and there is no gratitude from Mao, is there? He thinks this is what we're owed from the 19th century. You owe us.
Yeah. And then in lots of other Mao's writings, where Mao twigged that Stalin's initial deal with him was quite one-sided in Russia's favour.
Exploitative, yeah.
He said, look, just like how things were, you know, in the 1860s.
Absolutely.
Mao has a kind of an interesting view, not shared with the Soviet Union, on the kind of succession of world leadership. His view was, well, I surely, now that Stalin has died, I am the heir apparent to the leadership of world communism.
Yes.
The idea that it goes down the line to one of Stalin's subordinates, well, that's patently ridiculous. Did Khrushchev bring, you know, half a billion people into under the communist flag? I don't think so.
Yeah, well, you've got that famous image, and I don't know if your leader's known it, but you and I collaborated on a textbook project, and in the research for that, and it was actually the picture I wanted to be on the front cover, was the one of Marx and Engels and Lenin and Stalin, showing that progression.
Yeah.
What I wasn't aware of until I started researching this book was that there was a Chinese variant of that picture, has Mao on the end.
Yeah.
And so I posed this question in the textbook of how would a Soviet have reacted to this image with Mao kind of on the end? And I think they would have thought it was little less than vandalism.
Yeah. Or preposterous.
Yeah, absolutely. Who is this backwards caveman peasant of a country that is big, but it's Mickey Mouse country, and here you're saying that you're world leader, you know, you've been communist China for 7 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is it. And then how does it spiral? that if Mao and Stalin didn't get on, at least Mao had respect for Stalin's leadership. Mao and Khrushchev cannot stand each other.
No.
And, so many instances of them not getting on and really being quite petulant to each other that it only worsens the situation. Khrushchev, for instance, says of the Great Leap Forward that it's totally unworkable. You know, we tried it 20 years ago. It didn't work. Why do you think it's going to work? And ironically, a lot of Mao's defence for the Great Leap Forward was the working of a Soviet scientist, Trofim Lysenko,
who
the ideas are later proven to be fraudulent, but there's something kind of perverse that Mao supports his ideas with the ideas of a Soviet thinker. It's kind of like almost him saying, I'm trying to be a good boy, I'm trying to do it the Soviet way, but almost presenting Khrushchev as turning un-Soviet.
Yes. So when you get to the later 1950s and you have disasters like the Great Leap Forward and the Great Famine,
yes,
where statistical ranges and really really differ. Where I think it was Frank Dakota said that it could be anything between 40 and 80 million who died. There's actually, I think, a connection between the Sino-Soviet split and the disaster of the Great Leap Forward.
Oh.
In that Mao now had to show this non-entity Khrushchev how you do things and how you leapfrog ahead of capitalist countries in a generation. And the method he employs is a kind of a Maoist... Maoist kind of approach by saying, look, we mobilise the entire population. You want to see what a revolutionary peasantry can do? This is it. You you get the entire peasant population to do, you know, rather daft things like down tools in the field and go and build dams where we work them to death. And of course the result is a disaster on kind of almost historically unforeseen levels.
Yeah.
And again, part of it comes from just as the kind of the Soviet famines and collectivization were partly born of Stalin's worldview of looking at the threats beyond Soviet borders and then thinking, what do we have to do in the Soviet Union to build the country up? I believe Mao was in exactly the same position of thinking how do we seize control of the kind of the workings of global communism? Because, you know, if from Mao's perspective, had the Great Leap Forward worked, then there would be no question of his leadership.
Yeah, I don't think it's wholly relevant to this debate, but there's also a Sino-Soviet split over the leadership of African nations, which had just been freed from their colonial yoke from British or French rule, adopted communism, and there's this real kind of it's almost another scramble for Africa, really, of the Sinophide and the Marxist-Leninist versions trying to appeal. That you do have the economic, and it all happens as well, as you're implying, within this kind of global scene. Now, I think the biggest reason for the split is Khrushchev's view of what is called peaceful coexistence.
Sure.
Now, Khrushchev had lost a son during World War II. The impact of war had visited him personally. Yes, Mao also lost his son Mao Anying in Korea in 1950, so there is a parallel there.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
But whereas Mao sees the death of his son, or whether he sees this or whether this is just what he says he sees that as himself making a sacrifice for China, which is, you know, it's ludicrous, frankly. But the experience of losing a son had a very different effect on Khrushchev. Now, Khrushchev's full of bluster. He barks. I'm not sure he bites. Mm. But he is aware that war, nuclear war, is upon us. It's something very different. So at an international conference in, I believe, 1957, where I think Deng was speaking on behalf of the CCP, and pretty much says, we will... If America drops a bomb on us, good, because we've got the population to absorb that. They don't, and then we're going to attack them. And it's an Italian communist leader says, well, okay, I hear what you're saying. I don't agree. I hear what you're saying. What if America or a capitalist country dropped a bomb on Italy? It would wipe out our entire nation, our entire civilization. And this... CCP delegate turns around and says, well, what's the big deal about Italy? Because it's what you said right at the beginning, that communism is about social classes, not about national identity.
Yeah.
But that kind of flippancy sets the Soviets off. They're like, we've got a maverick here, a ticking time bomb, and we can't support him to the extent that he wants us to support him, because what will he do with what we're going to give him?
Yeah.
Mao wants nukes, he wants submarines capable of launching them. And Khrushchev says, no way, because you would do something that would provoke World War III.
Yeah.
So you've got that international element, the economic element.
And did not Mao look at the kind of the early moves towards détente? Didn't Mao look at that as essentially weakness?
Yes, cowardice and betrayal.
Yeah, he said basically... you know, his view of, say, the Korean War was, well, we won it. We beat the capitalists. Which, I mean, you know, that's one way of looking at the Korean War. I'm not sure I entirely subscribe to that.
No.
But that's what he and large numbers of people in China did believe. And he viewed easing of tensions with the capitalist world, as being a sign of weakness. And again, we come back to this theme of kind of the personal identities and politics, and Mao seeing himself as the tough guy. But also on an ideological level, his view was that communism had to be belligerent. I'm just reading the first volume in Stephen Kotkin's trilogy on Stalin at the moment. And he makes the point that by about 1923-24, the big conversation in the Soviet Communist Party was that revolution wasn't going to spread. In order to build socialism in one country, you need to have reasonable relations in terms of trade and technology transfers with the capitalist world, and that is just the nature of that. You won't be able to undermine them or overthrow them, not in a generation. And this was Stalin saying this. So by the time you get to Khrushchev, the idea that the Soviet Union is going to spread world revolution, that's kind of for the birds, really. And I don't think there were many people in the Soviet Union that believed that for a moment. But I do think that Mao's view of the Soviet Union was you're the kind of the tired old man. You've had your day and it didn't work out. We're the young bloods now.
I think that's exactly it. Because for the Russians at this stage, world communism is some kind of whimsical end goal. It's the system of capitalism will exploit the poor to the extent that they will revolt and overthrow capitalism in their own country. Whereas Mao's view is drop a bomb on them and that will help get the process going quicker.
Yeah.
So you can understand why the Russians think what they think about the Chinese, but also to an extent you can see, as you've said, the Chinese just think the Russians are, they've sold out.
Yeah.
This whole idea of détente is betrayal of the working classes.
Yeah. And so then we get to the height of tensions that coincide with the Cultural Revolution.
Yeah.
Do you think that there is this is a bit of a straw man question, really. The answer is obviously yes. But what is the relationship between the Sino-Soviet split and the Cultural Revolution, do you think?
Because I don't know, Nick. When I applied to become a teacher, I literally had the interview and they said, you got the job and you're going to teach four groups of lower sixth China. I was like, oh, fantastic. And I got out the door shut. I was like, my God, I don't know anything about China. So I had to learn it. And the one part of the course that was really, really tough to get was the Cultural Revolution. Because at first reading, it makes no sense.
Yeah.
And then at second and third reading, it makes no sense. Yeah. And eventually, the bits of the puzzle fall into place, that basically a country will entirely purge itself for the country's benefit.
Yeah. I'm very much with you there, and I always try to take the beginner's mind to looking at history. And the Cultural Revolution for me will be like almost like the quantum physics of the 20th century. I keep looking at it thinking, I just find this so unfathomably kind of multidimensional and complex, and when I feel I've understood it, I make the mistake of reading another book on it, and then boom. But yes, it was a country, as you say, trying to purge itself and trying to go from political revolution, which had happened, social revolution, which had happened, and this kind of deeper, almost existential revolution.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is the curious bit, and happens to be terrifically violent. What do you think is the... Because obviously the Sino-Soviet split reaches its height in sort of 67 to 69, where you're facing kind of open war.
Yes.
Do you think Mao was motivated by the Sino-Soviet split to bring about the Cultural Revolution?
That's a tough question, isn't it? I would suggest no, because I find Mao so kind of arrogant. I would have thought his thinking would have been far more internal than that. But the parallels are huge. So the two great targets of the Cultural Revolution are bureaucracy and revisionism.
Mm-hmm.
And the Soviet Union is an incredibly bureaucratic communist state. It is not dynamic. It is not... You know, whenever you hear someone say, oh my God, they're communist, you're Marxist, and you have this vision of huge social upheaval. The Russians, for them, they've done that. Their revolution was 1917, and now they are a bureaucratic nation. So that sets them at odds. The idea of attacking revisionism, that is the very cornerstone of Khrushchev's policy,
yeah,
dates on with the US. So both of those principles are at odds. Does Mao decide to launch? I think Mao decides to launch the Cultural Revolution as a kind of whitewash of the total economic disaster that was the Great Leap Forward.
Yeah.
And he's trying to retain his own ideological dominance in the Soviet Union. But there is one very, very, very interesting element involving the Soviet Union, which is in 1968, the Soviet Union, under their new leader, Leonid Brezhnev, him of the eyebrows, is that they are going to actively involve themselves in any communist nation where communism is under threat. Now, for Brezhnev, I'm 100% sure this means to avoid uprisings like Hungary in 1956, and looking right at the here and now, it's the Prague uprisings of 68.
Mm-hmm.
However, Mr. Paranoid Mao believes, hold on, what if they look at our Cultural Revolution that is attacking elements that are fundamental to Soviet Marxist-Leninism? Are they going to interpret us on the Cultural Revolution as an instance of anti-communism happening in a socialist state? Are they going to invade, basically?
Mm-hmm.
No. Because I credit the Soviets with a little bit more worldliness than that. However, for Mao, you know, Mao's building underground nuclear defences, which I believe are never completed, but I believe a whole load of Beijing, it still exists, this underground network.
Yeah.
Mao, despite this huge bravado, is convinced that not only will the Soviets invade, he is convinced that the Soviets would defeat China. And he's quite right. It gets to the extent that Mao, this is, you know, look at this with your 2020 eyes. Mao saw the Soviet Union, a communist country, as a greater threat to China, a communist nation's existence, than America,
yes,
the leader of world capitalism. I think that's a remarkable conclusion to reach.
Which neatly brings us on to the Nixon visit in 1972, and this has a huge bearing on the Sino-Soviet split. Obviously, this was the great diplomatic triumph of Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger, and probably one of the greatest diplomatic coups of the 20th century. But obviously, the Americans were fully aware of the Sino-Soviet tensions and saw this as a terrific opportunity, didn't they?
Absolutely. And a huge opportunity. And all they had to do was to sell Taiwan down the river,
mm-hmm,
which they do very happily, because Taiwan and America had an agreement in 1954, which pretty much says, protect us from China. During that Nixon period, I think 71, they abrogate arrangement.
Yeah.
Taiwanese had just left, and then you have this growing alliance. I think Ronald Reagan's the man who goes over to reassure Taiwan that we still got your back, but we can't have this treaty because it stops our policy imperative here.
Yeah.
So, you know, from that Nixon visit, though, it is a turning point in modern Chinese history. As a famous image, and there's Nixon flanked by Zhou Enlai on what this great moderate survivor of the CCP. And on the other side, Jiang Qing, Mao's wife, the leading militant in the party. And you wonder what the conversation there was. But it's indicative that actually leaves Nixon out of the equation, one of the more right-wing and anti-communist American leaders of the post-World War II period, up until now. And you kind of see a picture that in the 1960s wouldn't have made sense.
Yeah.
By the early 1970s, this is happening.
Yeah. And what I see at that point is there was this whole unwritten Roosevelt doctrine, wasn't there, that you would have a multipolar world. This would be the ideal world to have after the Second World War, basically the British Empire, America, China and the Soviet Union, with all with spheres of influence. And then you get the worst of all worlds. You know, Britain's bankrupt at the end of the war, loses its empire. China's in the civil war. So then you have, from 1945 onwards, a bipolar world, which is much more dangerous. And then you wind up in the 1970s. The Nixon visit is the emergence of a kind of like a multipolar world, which, for a canny politician like Nixon, is presents lots of opportunities. And you're almost looking at kind of the reinvention of European great power politics that you saw with, you know, Austria, Germany and Russia and that kind of thing. And so obviously the Politburo in Moscow panic. They invite Nixon to Russia very, very quickly after that. And Nixon, you know, the golden egg that Nixon gets really is the help of the Soviets and the Chinese to extricate America from Vietnam, and to put pressure on the North Vietnamese and to end arms sales and all that kind of useful stuff. So the Sino-Soviet split, I suppose, doesn't so much end as to some degree kind of fizzle out. One might argue that it ends with the early 1990s, finally, with the end of communism.
Yeah, because even if we look at the Nixon visit, it's very much in the stage of Maoist China, where two pertinent questions were after Mao who, and more importantly, after Mao what.
Yeah.
And as we can see now, looking backwards, that Mao Zedong thought, to a large extent, does die with Mao. The communist China under Deng, which still survives today, is based on a broadly capitalist economy with a very authoritarian social rule, which ironically is the great Maoist legacy. Look at Tiananmen Square and currently, the ongoing situations for the Muslims in Xinjiang and the Buddhists in Tibet. So an ongoing legacy of Mao is actually that control.
Yeah.
And that's very Maoist, and I think you could date that straight back to Stalin, because that's it. Economically, though, I think with Deng wanting to follow a more technological and scientific method, that really puts the apple there, the tempting apple. This is like the Garden of Eden. What is that apple? It is technological assistance, which the Americans can and do provide. And I think that is where you see the China of today being born. And America be rubbing their hands with glee, because they actually get what they want, and there's no huge Third World War.
Yeah. I mean, ironically, in America, this has led to the seeds of a kind of a deep resentment towards China. You know, they pinched all our ideas and they've taken our technology and that kind of stuff. But what it gave America in the end, which is, this is the subject of another totally different podcast, is massive markets and enormous labour markets to access, which have powered globalisation in the 80s and 90s and provided American companies with staggering amounts of wealth. But anyway.
It's fulfilling the British vision of the 1830s, where with zero consideration of ethics, we go to war to China over the issue of opium.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Now it's just about sort of microchips for smartphones, but there
Spot
you go.
On. Spot on.
Well, let's end there, Larry, and thank you so much for your thoughts and input today. And it would be lovely to chat further about China and other topics with you, if you'd be willing to come back on the show at a certain point in the future.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for having me. Thank you for the invite. I've really enjoyed it. You highlight of my half term so far.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much for that. And I hope your listeners found it informative.
Okay, all the best, Larry.
Cheers. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. So I hope you found that useful and interesting. And once again, huge thanks to Larry Orton-Leaf. And we'll be resuming normal services next week. And I hope you guys, if you're studying, you have a great half-term holiday, or whatever else you're doing, Take care. Do remember to swing by our Facebook group, and also if you can check out our Patreon. We survive on a little bit of advertising revenue and the kindness of our patrons. Do take care, everybody. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.